Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com and this is Donald Maas. Donald is the founder of the Donald Maas Literary Agency in New York, as well as the author of several books on writing fiction, including his latest, The Breakout Novelist. So welcome, Donald.
Thank you so much, Joanna.
Great, so why don't you start by telling us why you've written this book and why it's so important for authors?
Well, this is a book which I intended originally for professional working novelists. It may surprise some previous writers to know that professional novelists get stuck. And they can get stuck at many different stages of a given project, from inception to planning and plotting to the polish. There are any number of places where you can run into the top. When that happens, what do you do if you're a professional novelist? Well, you might finish your work and submit it to your agent or your editor or whatever, but that's very late in the process, and by that time, time is often running short. There are times and so forth. You need to be able to fix problems as they come up, and how do you do that? Who do you turn to? Do you have a script doctor on call? Well, most don't, and that's the reason I put together this book. I will flash it for your...
Beautiful.
The Breakout Novelist. And it's a compilation of my previous writing books, Writing the Breakout Novel, the Writing the Breakout Novel Workbook, and the Fire and Fiction, and all the story and character development exercises in those books. I keep this book, hopefully, by your keyboard, and when you run into a problem with characters or plot or what have you, you can flip through, find an exercise to help you get unstuck.
Great. I've read the book. It's fantastically useful for writers. And you talk, near the beginning about a breakout premise. And to me, if you haven't got that right, you could be going a long way and getting things wrong. So what do you mean about a breakout premise?
Well, a premise for a story is the thing that is going to drive all the story events that occur in the novel. And you can start with a weak premise. And that's not going to push you to create much of story, not to happen. So a breakout premise is one that necessarily demands that a lot happen in the story in order for things to work out. I'll give you an example. If you want to write about journeying home to reconcile with mom after, a certain number of years, that's a fine premise for a story. There's nothing wrong with that, but it's not necessarily going to generate a good story. But if you send a character home to reconcile with mom, but that character is a policewoman, and her mom is accused of murder at the same time, well, now you've got inherent, what I call inherent conflict. In other words, there are built-in conflicts and the premise that are going to demand that story events happen. So a breakout premise is one that generates a lot of story, and one of the ways to do that is with conflict that you can't avoid, and conflict that isn't easily resolved.
And in the book, you talk about conflict and tension and keeping that going and not letting the reader, even rest for a minute. And I wondered, how are people going to achieve that in genres that are not, say, thrillers?
Well, what you're talking about is a technique that I call micro-tension. That's the line-by-line tension that keeps every next thing on the page. That is not a function of plot. In fact, story events by themselves generate only a very limited amount of tension. What keeps us going page by page, paragraph by paragraph, line by line is something else. Even a scene goal, a strong purpose for a scene, isn't going to keep a reader reading for 15 pages or so. You need micro-tension to do that. And micro-tension works in a very different way tension works. Micro-tension is different depending on what you're doing on the page, but I'll give you another example. There's a book here in the States that has been on the trade paperback bestseller list for a very long time. It's called an author named Robert Gulrich. First novel. The novel opens in 1907 in the northern United States as a rich man is waiting for the woman he hopes will become his wife. He's advertised in news for a sort of a mail order bride, a woman that he hopes will be a reliable wife, hence the title. The opening of this book involves this man standing on a railroad station platform in his town, waiting for the train. He stands there on that platform doing nothing for 20 printed pages. Absolutely nothing happens, and it is riveting reading. And this book has been a bestseller for a long time now. How did that? There's no plot. There's nothing happening. The tension that keeps you reading has got to come from something else. And the way he did it in this particular case is that he made this man conflicted, inwardly conflicted, like 20 different ways, and drew out the fine nuances of all this internal conflict very, very powerfully. And so for 20 pages of nothing happening, you're so compelled to read. Microtension works differently in dialogue, it works differently in... I discuss all that in the book, but it's an absolutely essential component. It's what I call the third level of story. There's plot, macro plot, there's scene goals, and then there's micro tension that keeps us reading every line.
And another thing that you talk about a lot is obviously the characters and caring about the protagonist. And you do talk about stakes and personal stakes. Maybe you could just explain how writers can be sure that a reader will care about their character enough to carry on reading.
Well, I think you have to start with the assumption that the reader is not going to care about your character or what is happening to them. I mean, should they? You care as the author. You're deeply invested in this person. You spend a lot of time, but the reader doesn't necessarily care. And in particular, with what's happening to the character, you know, it can be very dramatic. It can be high action, or it can be personal, some sort of personal journey story. It doesn't really matter. The reader has no reason to be invested in that. The way the reader comes to care is when the character himself or herself cares. Now, for them to care a little bit, doesn't matter that much, won't make a big difference. But if you can deepen the reasons why a character cares about what's happening, if you can find more reasons that it has personal meaning, then you deepen the personal stakes of that character in the story. You give the reader, you know, chapter by chapter, scene by scene, more and more reasons to care about what's happening. The more reasons you give the character to care about what's happening to them, the more reasons the reader will have about that. You can't take it as an automatic assumption and then just string events all the way through the story. The character that you're writing about needs to become more and more personally invested in what's happening, have more reasons to care. That's critical.
So I wanted to ask you, you know, I was just thinking about the role of an agent and, you know, in a very small way nowadays, those of us with a Kindle are downloading these samples and we're reading the first few pages and deciding whether or not to buy, which I guess is kind of what you do. Would that be true? And how can writers make sure the first few pages grab somebody like yourself?
Is that I look for immediately in the opening pages of the story. The first is a strong reason to care about this character. There are three different types of protagonists, and there are three different ways in which I can come to care about those characters immediately. With ordinary people, your every man or every woman type protagonist, seeing some quality of strength in them, a little sample of heroism, of something good, principled, or even humorous about them, opens a window into that person's, you know, deepest self and allows me to see, hey, there's something good about this character. I have a reason to keep going with them. With heroic characters, like you might find in kinds of stories, thrillers and whatnot, they're already heroic, so it would seem that the job is done. But actually, those characters can also be uninvolving, and the reason is that they're too perfect. They're too good and too strong and too heroic. What we need to see in that way in which they're perfectly human, so we have a connection to them. And then there are dark protagonists who are, well, you know, think vampires. But you would think vampires being nowadays young, set, and, you know, very comfortable in nightclubs, you would think that they would automatically be appealing. That's not true. What we need to see in them is a longing for the redemption that they're eventually going to experience. Some way, the easiest way to do that is to show the reader in which that character wants to change or become more human, less tormented, if they're struggling and reaching for redemption already, then we have a reason to hope for them and we have a reason to go forward. Just because they're tormented, dark and sexy and undead, doesn't care. I go through 300 or 400 pages of them. The second thing that I look for at the beginning of a manuscript is, does it keep me reading line by line? Does that microtension start working right away? Do I feel compelled to go forward every line, every paragraph, every page? That doesn't often, I can tell you.
The thing you mentioned in the book, I was interested in the sort of category of literary commercial is what you mentioned. And that, you know, there's a lot of discussion on literary versus genre fiction. Maybe you could explain what literary commercial means.
It's a very good question. Industry, there's a term, literary slash commercial, and it means literary fiction that's written, but nevertheless sells very, very well. Books like Water for Elephants. Now, how do you achieve that effect? How can you write beautifully and tell a great story sensibly? Commercial storytellers need to sort of embrace the things that literary writers do well and use all the tools of good fiction that we have. It's not about pretty words necessarily. It's about structuring a book so that there are strong themes and parallels and reversals, symbols and things like that, which any writer can do. Now, conversely, for literary writers, how do you make a story as strong for the help or whatnot? Well, mostly literary writers don't want to plot. They think of plot as something gimmicky. If you conceptualize instead that your novel is made up of events, external things that we can see and hear, you can then take any internal moment in a character's journey and then, if it's important, externalize it, find a way to dramatize it in a way that could be videotaped or audiotaped. If you think of it as dramatizations of a character's transformation, then, you know, that really is plot in a literary novel. It's about making strong events in a story, and anybody can do that. So there any writer, commercial or literary, to do better the part of the business that they don't do well. And that, hopefully, in the end, produces this, what we call literary commercial fiction.
Another really common question that authors have, and, you know, everybody talks about, is this author's voice type of thing. And many new writers just go, what is that anyway? You know, so what is it to you, and how do writers find their voice?
Voice is one of those fuzzy, hard to pin down terms that you hear in the industry a lot. It's like the word edgy. What does that mean? Very, very hard to quantify. But I think the easiest way to get a handle on it is to realize that for most writers, when we're talking about voice, what we're talking about is characters' voices. It's certainly possible for an authorial voice to be on the page. You know, it's a legitimate technique, and you see it used sometimes nowadays. But most of the time in contemporary fiction, we're working from the point of view of a particular character. So it is their thoughts, what they hear, what they feel, and what they think that we're reading about on the page. Therefore, what we're doing really is getting into the head, mind, ears, and heart of that character. So it's how they perceive things, how they relate things, how they think to themselves or feel to themselves about things that either is distinctive and unique and particular to them, or is generic, bland, hackneyed, and interesting. So to create a strong voice, I think the easiest thing an author can do is to look at their character and make their character as unique as possible. Hackneyed, cliched emotions aren't going to have much of a voice. But nuanced, secondary emotions, surprising thinking that takes us sideways into an issue or something that's happening, that will have a voice. So think about your character and what makes your character different and what makes your character's experience unique. Capture that on the page and you have voice.
Another interesting thing, so in the book you separate it into kind of the writing and then the author's career, I guess, as well. And one of the things you say is that the author's best champion is themselves. Maybe you could talk a bit about what that means, and you know, does that is that affected by the changes in the industry at the moment?
You know, it's kind of a truism in the business today that authors have to promote themselves. I mean, you know, authors today will do more to promote themselves in most cases than publishers will, and this is particularly true for fiction writers. There are a lot of reasons for that. Fiction is difficult to promote. Getting media attention, television, and things like that, and radio for fiction authors, it doesn't play very well on those media sites to promote. So authors take it upon themselves, and there are a lot of new ways to do it with social media and so forth and so on. But I want to make a point here, which is that being your own champion isn't just about making people aware of you, just about the physical book and selling it to consumers or forming a relationship with fans. That's important, but it's only part of the picture. Another part of the picture is being a champion of your own writing. In other words, being your own best critic, being your own cheerleader. Let me put it this way. Nobody is going to push your story deeper or push you deeper into your characters than you will. Your critique partners, your agent, your editor will all have nice things to say and have comments to offer and suggestions, but those are only as much as they can give you. That character, that story lives in you, and you can either mine it for everything, or you can do what makes you, what is easy and makes you feel comfortable, and let it go at that. Probably revise based on an editor's suggestions, but that's going to leave you with a story that doesn't fulfill its potential. If you really want to be a champion for yourself, hard. Make your story bigger, deeper, more powerful. The more you do that, the more that's going to have that effect.
The other thing that was interesting in the book, and it is a career guide, as you say, it's meant to be for professional writers, and the rest of us are reading it, you know, with glee. But you talk about this five book effect or something along those lines, where things happen after five books. Maybe you could talk a bit about that.
Well, people tend to, pre-published, tend to think that once you get your first book contract, you find an agent, you get a publisher, wow, you're set, you're in the door, everything happens automatically from there, and that's not really true. The fact is, the ultimate customer in this business is not an agent or an editor, or even a bookseller. The ultimate customer is a reader out there somewhere who finds your books and or finds your book, likes it, and then goes to and purchases the second book. Now, the five book threshold is a variable number, but what I mean by that is that in order to reach a critical mass of readers who are going to start to grow and snowball your audience, on average, it takes about five titles for that to happen. Word of mouth is the main mechanism by which an audience grows. There have been studies done that show why people buy books. The number one reason, really, is that people buy books by authors that they're already familiar with. In other words, fans buy books of their favorite authors. That's most of the fiction sales. When readers find new authors, it's mostly happens because somebody has convinced them to try a new author. It can happen in a bookshop, it can happen in a book club, it can happen online, it can happen any number of ways, but typically it's word of mouth. That's what you're counting on. Now, the word of mouth takes a little time to work. And it works better and better the more readers you have, and hence you need more than one title to grow the size of that audience from a small kernel to a bigger set, and the bigger people there are, the more people there are to talk. So that's why authors, audiences, or sales tend to grow exponentially in an upward rising curve. So, I mean, in every case, authors, oh, people can go on a downward curve. That's not so nice. But authors need to understand that just getting published doesn't solve all your problems and doesn't mean you automatically have a career. Well, good stories, if not great stories, again and again, and that's how your audience grows.
Now, I have a question, and it's you know, slightly different. It's based on you being an agent and the changes in the industry right now and what we've just seen with Amanda Hocking and some other people. Do you now accept pitches from self-published authors who have Kindle success? And what is Kindle success to agents and publishers?
Do we hear from Kindle authors? We can't avoid hearing from Kindle authors. I mean, contact us constantly. Is this a valid route to recognition? You know, in most cases, it really isn't. Most Kindle sales are pretty small. Every once in a while, probably once a year, there's somebody who breaks through in that way, like Amanda Hocking, and builds an audience. That's pretty rare. So what are we looking for Kindle editions? We're looking for the very same things that we're looking for when we read an unpublished manuscript. You know, is it a compelling story? Are there characters we care about? Is it a fascinating premise? Is it wonderfully written? All the things that make good fiction. If that's true in a Kindle edition, very likely that edition is going to be doing pretty well. Not necessarily, but probably. So I guess my point here is that whether you publish a Kindle edition or what's going to make that edition successful, either on Kindle or later for agents and traditional paper publishers, is the same thing, great storytelling. So, you know, it's nice to think about Kindle and it's to recognition and publication. It's not very successful in most cases. I think it rewards people for writing a manuscript and not necessarily finishing that manuscript or taking it as far as it needs to go to be a great novel. And that may be why they don't, generally speaking, sell very well. But that said, if you can write a great story, you can publish a successful Kindle edition. Probably will sell well, attention of people like me. But then again, written a great novel, you probably don't need that Kindle edition to get that recognition anyway. The point is, write a great story first. That solves all your problems.
So just finish off by telling people where they can find you and your book.
Well, they can find me and my literary agency in New York on the web at www.mossagency.com, and Moss is spelled MAAAGENCY.com. My books are available on Amazon, or if you can't find it there, the publisher in the United States is Writer's Digest Books, and they can ship to Australia. So you can go to their website, writersdigest.com, and search in their shop, and you'll find it pretty quickly.
Well, thanks ever so much for your time, Donald. That was great.
You're very welcome. It's nice to chat with you. Morning for you.